subjects about which I get more interest in the South than just about any other is the subject of the Scots-Irish. And it just so happens that the reason for that is that most of the people I meet are descended from the Scots-Irish. There are whole states full of them, like West Virginia and Ohio, different places. In 1780, a British major, Patrick Ferguson, led an army of hand-picked New York and New Jersey American Tories, that is, men loyal to the king. The king's always getting in the way, isn't he? Against the king's enemies, their fellow Americans loyal to Congress, George Washington, and independence, on a campaign against Western North and South Carolina. The British Army under Lord Cornwallis had whipped American armies at 96, at Charleston, at Savannah, at Camden. And the American cause was very bleak in 1780. A British colonel by the name of Ferguson was given the assignment of bringing in rebels, that is, Americans, who lived on the frontier areas of the Carolinas and Virginia, to bring them in and make them loyal subjects to the crown. And for the most part, these people, these mountain people, had skipped the war for independence. They hadn't gotten involved too much. They were called the Over the Mountain Men. And Major Ferguson, who was famous in his own right and a man that I really admire. He invented a great sniper rifle and he put together a company of rangers that fought against the Americans at the Battle of Brandywine. And there's some interesting stories about Major Patrick Ferguson. But he made the mistake of his life in 1780, which was not going to exist much longer after he made this mistake. He declared to the people the mountains of the Carolinas in Virginia, that he was going to come with fire and sword and lay waste to their homes if they didn't come down and swear their allegiance to King George and actually join the Tory armies that were assembling to finish off the American rebels. Well, who were these men that were being threatened? These militias had various names. They were called the Over the Mountain Men. They were also known as the Scots-Irish. Their family names were Shelby, Campbell, Ridley, Webb, Jackson, Calhoun, McPherson, Douglas, Brown, MacArthur, Adams, McGregor, McMurtry, etc. These were all men who lived up in the mountains. They lived in the hollows and the glens of the Western Carolinas, in Kentucky and in Tennessee. And they had not been welcome along the coasts of America when they had come from Ireland. They were English-dominated. They had flooded west and south through the first 70 years of the 18th century, that is the 1700s. The generation and two generations after the Covenanters. For during the times of the Covenanters, many Scotsmen had transplanted themselves to Northern Ireland and to Ireland and other places, but especially the province of Ulster. James Webb, a former senator from Virginia, said this in his book on the Scotch-Irish. He said they were the kind of people you would want covering your back in a barroom brawl or protecting your flank in the next foxhole while waiting for an enemy to make a night attack. They were the kind of people who would fight like madmen and after it was over, would look down at a dead friend or relative and cry like babies. They were the kind of people who would die in place rather than retreat if they had given you their word that they would be there for you. And they were not the kind of people you would ever, ever set in action against you. Well, the Scots-Irish were a warrior culture who lived simply. They trusted their families implicitly. And they hated government authority who took away their rights and freedoms. They lived in independent little communities based on their kinship networks. and they believed in a straightforward Calvinist Reformed gospel and faith. These were men whose grandparents had been Covenanters. These were men who had been members of the Kirk in Scotland. Their grandparents had, and their parents, and their great-grandparents. And at one generation or another, they had transferred themselves to Northern Ireland, and there established an Irish Presbyterian church, and from there had come to America. Well, these are the men that were being challenged by Major Patrick Ferguson, who was a Scotsman himself. He had raised these folk to a white-hot pitch, and they were coming to him. The major was a Scot and a brave man, deserving of a better cause. His ill-tempered challenge to the Scots-Irish mountaineers only hastened his own earthly departure. Or as James Webb has stated it, he instigated an invitation to his own funeral. Thus began the final campaign that resulted in the loss of Britain's American empire. The British major heard that an army was coming after him, and he established a defensive line along a mountainous ridge right on the border between North and South Carolina, ironically named, in one of the great ironies of history, King's Mountain. The two forces were essentially equal in numbers, but not in zeal. The reckless every man his own commander assault by the mountaineers was like nothing the Redcoats had ever experienced in the war, and of course most of them would never get to think about it again. As these mountaineers arrived at King's Mountain, they were led by a variety of colonels who had their own command, and nobody would follow the advice or the commands of anybody else other than their own leader, kind of like the clans. Some New England Congregationalists despised them. In fact, the New England Puritans said of the Scots-Irish when they came to New England that they kept the Sabbath and everything else that's not tied down. And they kept on moving through, going into western Pennsylvania and western Maryland and western Virginia, and then moving north and south along the mountain ridges to fill the South and the Ohio Valley. The character and culture of the Scots developed over hundreds, perhaps thousands of years prior to their coming to America. And certain traits are identified with the Scots-Irish in America. Their disposition to keep moving into the frontier, their headlong aggressive tactics in a fight, the centrality and love of family and clan, and their willingness to die for them. Resistance to tyranny and love of liberty are all of ancient lineage. Their uncompromising attachment to the belief that man's total depravity and God's sovereignty, predestination, the regulative principle of worship, and republican church government entered their souls during the Reformation. They, as historian William Latimer put it this way, the principles of Protestantism sank into their hearts and changed the habits of their lives. In two generations, men of clay became men of iron. And that was in the 16th century. And these men of iron, many of them, as they were impoverished by what was taking place in Scotland in those days, would move to greener fields. They'd move to Ireland. In fact, the British liked the Scots to move into Ireland because they provided a buffer between the English governance of Ireland and the wild Irish that lived there. And the Scots, these strict oatmeal-eating Scots Presbyterians who came to Northern Ireland, were seen by the British as a good filler to keep the native population subdued and to bring prosperity to Ireland. So they were Scots, but after a couple generations, they became Scots-Irish, which is a uniquely American term for them. They were just considered Scots living in Ireland, and then eventually they were just called Irish, but they were the Orange Irish, after William of Orange. They were the Protestant Presbyterian Irish of Ulster Plantation, and eventually thousands and thousands of them came to America, going further and further west seeking their fortunes, places where there was liberty and freedom for them to raise their families and do what God had called them to do. And they came to America by the thousands. Of course, the Scots connection with John Calvin had come through the preaching of John Knox, and we know all about that. And the history of the Scottish Church is so closely associated with the Northern Irish. Many a covenanted Scottish Calvinist died for refusing to use the Book of Common Prayer or to bow to the bishops. During the 17th century, many Scots had moved to Ulster, and there they had to fight too. They had to fight. They had to fight the Irish from time to time. And of course, what happened with the Over the Mountain men as they surrounded King's Mountain? They formed 8 attacking sections. They encircled the mountain. They attacked Indian style. They fought like their ancestors had fought in Ireland and in Scotland. Ferguson's men fired volley after volley into the trees, mostly over the heads of the attacking American forces. Ferguson himself fell with 8 bullet holes in him. The mountaineers swarmed over the panicking redcoats with tomahawks and knives and cut them down with their long-barreled rifles. In the end, the attackers lost 28 killed and 62 wounded, and all 1,100 of the British troops, most of them loyalists. In fact, there was only one British soldier on the field, and that was Major Ferguson. The rest were Americans, but the Redcoats themselves were wiped out, most of them prisoners, but exactly they lost it all. The character of the Scottish people of the Lowlands and the Highlands was transferred to the men of Northern Ireland. They exhibited a certain tenacity of belief, a stubbornness of will, a willingness to fight to the death for one's religious convictions. And they brought that with them to America. The transplanted Scots took with them their church, their mores, their independent natures. One historian has described the Scottish settlers in America this way, and that is the Scots-Irish. The men would be dressed simply in wool sweaters and plaid trousers of their day, the women in linen skirts with plaid draped over their heads and pinned across their bosom and falling to their knees. Some would be shoeless. They'd be carrying few possessions, weapons, certainly, and perhaps a few days' supply of the ever-vital oatmeal to be mixed with milk into porridge or with water into gruel. They would be traveling not simply in families but in groups of families on their way to settle in little pockets of farmland that their lairds had marked out for them. And so they did in Ireland and in America too. The very first missionary, Scots-Irish missionary, to come to America was a man who settled in eastern Maryland. His name was Francis McKenney. And he was a pastor in Northern Ireland, and he came to pastor the increasing number of Scots-Irish in the 18th century that were gathering in America. For most of the pastors did not emigrate to America, but many of their parishioners did. And the Scots-Irish were going to face a problem that is going to plague them throughout their history in America, and that is that their church did not keep up with them. Their church did not keep up with this great migration of the Scotch-Irish coming to America. They were unable to provide enough pastors for the congregations that were established in America. And on the frontier, in later years, that's going to become a really big problem as America expands into Kentucky and the Mississippi Valley and Tennessee. Is the Scotch-Irish, while reformed in their theology and loving their catechisms and loving the scripture, but not having pastors. And who came along to scoop them up but the Methodists and the Baptists? The Methodists, you only had to feel the call, and you were ordained and put on a horse and given some literature, and off you went as a preacher of the Methodist Church. And so the Methodist circuit riders came and scooped up many of the Scotch-Irish on the frontier into their churches. Those who didn't have particular academic standards or theological standards for their ministers made a great deal of way among the Scots-Irish in the coming centuries. We know that they were a people who had a strong love of oratory and music. They invented many types of dancing and relished all forms of competition. Family and community gatherings ended up with bonfires, gaiety, and other entertainments like racing and wrestling, physical challenges. You can see the reflections of it today in the Scottish Games if you ever have attended those. In the summer of 2008, on a history tour of Scotland, we stopped in a little town of Ceres, where we witnessed the Highland Games that have been held every year since 1314. They had been created to celebrate the defeat of the English army at Bannockburn and by King Robert the Bruce. Music, food, fierce competition, folkways such as that traveled with the Scots wherever they went, and the Scots-Irish. The Ulster Scots were strong people, known for their practicality and for their intellects. Quote, they were hard-faced, thick-palmed farmers who doubled when necessary as ferocious, dedicated soldiers. The Scotch-Irish are going to become the backbone of the American armies in the coming centuries. The women married early and bore many children. When they eventually settled in America, the average Scotch-Irish family had 5 to 10 children, and some had many more than that. The women worked alongside the men in the fields and were themselves very hardy and self-reliant. No mamby-pambies among the Scots-Irish women. They accepted, quote, they accepted the judgments of their Presbyterian ministers, but they prayed while standing on their feet and not bent over on their knees. If any man, no matter how highly born, should strike or offend them, it was their credo to strike back twice as hard. One historian of the American Civil War has declared that since the Confederate Army was so dominated by the Scotch-Irish, that their heritage and character gave them their warrior ethos that caused them to attack without restraint and lose such huge numbers of men that it actually, especially when the odds were less than favorable, that character, as old Scotch-Irish Presbyterians from the hills had, that it cost them the war because so many men became casualties because they fought so headlong and without discipline. That's a book called Attack and Die, as you might guess, extremely controversial book by Grady McWhining. Life in Ireland for the Scots who came before the 18th century was generally tolerable, but subject to many disruptions. In fact, most of the Scots-Irish came in after 1704 for reasons that I will enumerate. A violent Catholic uprising in 1641 against English rule in Ireland resulted in many English and Scots being driven from their homes and killed. The Catholic Irish had tried to make it an anti-English rebellion, but it got out of hand and became anti-Protestant in general. The Scots themselves created their own force, which Foster writes, were effectively a covenanting force in arms for Parliament, against whom any royalist elements grudgingly stood down. That is, anybody who, even in the English army, who was confronted by these Scots-Irish who were coming to fight for the king, they had to stand down and give them preeminence. They were so ferocious when they went to war that it even scared their allies. The men from the Scottish Highlands had crossed to help, and many stayed after the fighting ended. Puritans and other dissenters from the Anglican Church, I might add, in Northern Ireland, ended up becoming Presbyterians and joining the Scots in Northern Ireland. That was a problem the Anglican Church faced, is their own parishioners were attracted to the simple biblical worship of the Presbyterian Irish, and as a result left their own Anglican communions and became themselves having intermarried and blended with the Scots-Irish culture. Perhaps the greatest military feat of those Scotsmen in Ireland occurred when the exiled James II, with a substantial French army, lay siege to Londonderry. Some of you have probably heard me tell the story on one of my CDs about, the one about great Christian armies. But it was just basically the farmers and merchants of Londonderry barricaded themselves in the city, behind the city walls, and there defended Londonderry against a siege of more than 20,000 French and Irish troops who bombarded the city for 9 months. This was in 1688. The Protestants inside the city collectively wrote their battle cry in blood, just as the Covenanters had done 50 years earlier. And by the way, the Covenanter banner, I actually brought one. It's out in the car. I didn't bring it in. The Covenanters had flags, and they wrote on the flags there, on their banners, their slogans and their sort of motivating statements of purpose. And I'll give it to you in a second. When I went to college, the college I went to was Baptist, and they had a great seal in the gymnasium, great blue, the college seal. And it had on the inside of it, for the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. But on the outside of it, and then there was a crown and a cross. And on the outside, in Latin, it said, Pro Corona et Fidere Christi. Well, the college I went to had been a Covenanter college in years past. And in 1952, it was given to some regular Baptists up in Cleveland, Ohio, and they had come and taken it over. And they had inherited this great seal, which said, Pro Corona et Fidere Christi, which I'm assuming they didn't know what it meant. I shouldn't say that. But it means for the crown and the covenant of Christ. And that was the slogan of Scotland. I mean, that was the motto of their country. For the crown and the covenant of God. Pro Corona et Fidere Christi. For the crown and covenant of Christ. And those were the banners that they put up. And they put them up in Londonderry. It was a tradition that they carried with them in their souls, if not on their banners. Well, eventually the English came and lifted the siege. More than 7,000 people had died inside the walls before the siege was over, and they were able to drive the French and Irish armies away. The event that spurred the four Scots-Irish migrations to America was Queen Anne's Test Act of 1704. It was aimed at subduing the dominant Presbyterian culture in Ulster. It required all political officials to become Anglicans. You couldn't serve in government. They barred non-Anglican pastors from their pulpits, and they made it criminal to officiate at weddings and funerals. And by the way, that's what happened to the Covenanters. They were not, the pastors, once they were thrown out of their churches, were not allowed to baptize or perform weddings. So any covenanting young people who got married, their children were all considered illegitimate by the state because they weren't married by Anglican bishops. And the covenanting pastors, of course, performed marriages all the time. They just ignored what the state was saying, and they said, God has commanded us to have a church, and this is what we do. And they continued the baptisms as well. But it was all considered illegitimate by the state, which said that they are the only ones who can tell a church what they can and cannot do. Well, Queen Anne's Test Act made it criminal to officiate at weddings and funerals. Non-Anglicans were forbidden to serve in the army. Throughout the 18th century, the entire British army was Anglican. They had no dissenters, no independents, no Presbyterians. It was illegal. And I think that the British Empire got a great deal of grief as a result of Queen Anne's Test Act of 1704, because all these Scotch-Irish came to America. And guess who was waiting for the British when the American War of Independence happened in the 1770s and 80s? Queen Anne was long gone. But God had used another providential measure to move thousands of his people from one place to another to start over again. And they started over again in the hills of America. The traditions of family loyalty and personal honor were carried to the New World in this migration. They traveled in tiny, crowded, disease-ridden two-masted ships that sailed from the ports of Londonderry and Belfast and other Port Rush and other places. Behind them, they were leaving crop failures and famines, 1740 and 41, 44 and 45, resentment over the test acts and other attempts to restrain their religious freedoms as well as their economic well-being. Most of them came through Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and they spread west into western Pennsylvania. In fact, western Pennsylvania became known as the Presbyterian Valley. In fact, the Ohio Valley became known as the Presbyterian Valley. And at one time in America, Pittsburgh was the only major city in the United States that was Protestant in the 20th century. And it was because it was the presence of Presbyterians from one end to the other, from about Ligonier west to the Ohio border. So many of the Covenanters and the Scotch-Irish had come. And then there was a surge in 1740 and 41 within the United States from Pennsylvania down into the Shenandoah Valley and then down into the Carolinas. So the Scotch-Irish continued moving westward and southward, and they filled up the frontier regions. Their fertility rate was 40% higher than any other group actually in the whole world. And they expanded exponentially. Modern DNA studies have proven that for whatever reason, people of Scottish origin are still the most prolific race in the world. Now, they deny that by only having one or none children in Scotland today. They haven't replaced their own population. And Scotland is filled with people from Poland and Czechoslovakia and Bulgaria and Turkey and other places. The average Scottish family today is 1.0 or 1.1 something children. But they are the most fecund race in the world. They're historically, families of 14, 15, 16 children was not uncommon among the Scots-Irish and among the Scots themselves. It's an interesting scientific discovery. By 1775, though, as many as 500,000 Scotch-Irish immigrants and their American-born descendants lived in the areas that I've mentioned. Within a few generations, the Scotch-Irish would expand into the Ohio Valley, Indiana, Illinois, Texas, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Shortly, they were in Arkansas, Kansas, Iowa, and Missouri, and identifiable as Scots-Irish. And it is interesting, wherever they went, as Dr. Moorcraft is fond of saying, wherever they went, they established a church, a school, and a distillery, not necessarily in that order. And if you go across Ohio, you will find little Presbyterian colleges across the landscape. They did establish educational institutions, for with the Reformation came the insistence that every man, woman, and child be able to read so they can study the Scriptures. And this kind of education was important to the Scots and the Scots-Irish. And in this country, they established small little Christian colleges wherever they went. And the one I attended was one of them, as a matter of fact. And till it became a Baptist, a Calvinistic Baptist, albeit. When the War for American Independence approached, the Scotch-Irish still defied the attempts of outsiders to control them. While most of them were still Calvinists and Presbyterian, they were wholly unlike the clean, orderly, town-bound descendants of the Puritans. Outside of pockets in the New Hampshire hills, New England and New York had very few Scotch-Irish. They had merely passed through on their way to the frontiers in the mountains. They asked for nothing from the government or anyone else, and nothing is what they usually received. They followed the wilderness road into the backcountry and the wagon trails into uncharted Piedmont regions in the mountains where only the Indians dwelt. And the government was happy for that because now the Scotch-Irish were a buffer zone, not between the wild Irish Catholics, but now they were a buffer zone between the Indians and the East Coast, between the civilized cities along the Atlantic seaboard and the wild, untamed wilderness area where the Scots just seemed right at home. They gravitated to areas that looked like home, and there they established their little villages and clans and etc. And the Indians, when the Indians attacked them, they fought like Scotch-Irish fought. And the Indians respected them as fellow warriors. And when the Indians didn't attack them, they established commercial relations with each other and basically had a peaceful relationship. As James Webb has observed, organized religion led by strong ministers was the backbone of the communities. The churches became vital centers of religious, social, and even political activity. In the 1750s, hard war came to the mountains, the French and the Indian War. They built blockhouse forts and fought in clan groupings, and they took losses not unlike previous centuries in Ireland and Scotland. In 1760 alone, the famous and powerful Calhoun family of South Carolina lost 23 of its members in fights just against the Cherokee. Following that war, King George III immediately began encroaching on the rights and freedoms of Americans, and they struck the first blow against the Scotch-Irish in the Proclamation Line of 1763. That was a move by Parliament to try and keep the Scots-Irish from moving westward into the Indian lands. Now, the problem with establishing a proclamation line along the ridge of the Appalachian Mountains, the big problem with that in 1763 was there was already 5,000 Scots-Irish on the other side of the line. And nobody's going to stop them from moving westward into areas where nobody lived. Unoccupied areas where they could build a cabin next to a creek, and that's what they did. You can't organize geographical boundaries against those kinds of people. While it is true that approximately 40% of the American Patriot Army were of Scotch-Irish heritage, they were not absent from the political discussions leading up to the war. It's often been observed that the Presbyterian form of church government, as well as such documents of freedom as the Declaration of Arbroath of 1320, influenced the writing of the Declaration of Independence, as well as the structure of government under the Articles of Confederation, and later, to some extent, the Constitution. It is less well known, except among scholars of the period, the Mecklenburg Declaration of North Carolina, which was made a year before the Declaration of Independence was issued, came from these Scotch-Irish. Let's see, I think I have a copy of that here. I'll never find it. The Mecklenburg Declaration, anyway, reads just like the Declaration of Independence. But it was made in Mecklenburg County, where Charlotte is today, and it was made by, what else? A bunch of Presbyterian elders who got together and they'd heard what happened up at Lexington and Concord, that the British had attacked. And these Presbyterian churchmen, got together and they declared their independence from England. Mecklenburg County seceded before anybody else did. And their declaration, which is controversial, there are some who say that they made it after the Declaration of Independence. I tend to believe that they made it this a year before, as they claimed. And if you look at the signees of this declaration, almost all of them are Scots-Irish, and most of them actually were elders, deacons, and pastors of the churches in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. We began this lecture with the Battle of Kings Mountain. After Kings Mountain, Lord Cornwallis attempted to stem the tide of rebellion of the mountaineers. He lost an entire army there on Kings Mountain. But he met more than his match at the Cowpens when Daniel Morgan led the Over the Mountain men in a great American victory. General Cornwallis took his decimated and tired and hungry army up to Yorktown, Virginia for a little R&R. And there George Washington, as you know, gobbled them up and put an end to the whole thing. The exemplar of Scotch-Irish manhood and type could be seen still 40 years later in President Andrew Jackson, whose father, mother, uncles, and cousins all came to the canebrakes of the Carolina border in Piedmont from the Ulster plantation. Stonewall Jackson, his forebears, in fact, Stonewall Jackson's great-grandmother and great-grandfather were both criminals. They were arrested and they were transported to America as indentured servants because the great-grandmother was accused of stealing something from the woman she worked for, and the great-grandfather was accused of stealing something from somebody, and they both got transported. They're not the paragons of Presbyterian virtue that we've been talking about, because frankly, not all the Scotch-Irish were either believers or paragons of public virtue, as they aren't today. So we always have to keep in mind that good old Mr. Potter tends to glamorize groups of people who are unglamorous and are sinful. But Stonewall Jackson's descent, Stonewall Jackson's antecedents came as transported criminals and moved westward. And eventually he was the product of that group. And Stonewall Jackson, we can lay claim to as a godly Scotch-Irishman. And there were many others throughout the years. Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, Lewis and Clark, both. Kit Carson, Ulysses S. Grant, Sam Houston, Nathan Bedford Forrest, George S. Patton, Theodore Roosevelt on his mother's side, Ronald Reagan, the paragon of virtue of Bill Clinton, the Hatfields and the McCoys, Sergeant Alvin York, Audie Murphy, David Hackworth, Saints and Sinners, all originally springing from the West, the wet soil north of Hadrian's Wall. No state has a higher percentage of those people than West Virginia. Heavily Scotch-Irish, West Virginia ranks first, second, or third in military casualties in every single U.S. war of the 20th century. It's two times that of New York and Connecticut in Vietnam, two and a half times those states in the war in Korea. Why is that? Well, the Scotch-Irish. Don't tell them what a war's about. Just tell them where it's at. And that's the way it's been. They revered and read the Bible. They, you know, not all of them valued higher education. Don't get me wrong. Many of them did not value education, but some did. There are still 63 Presbyterian colleges that began as Scotch-Irish schools. And a significant number did not survive into the 21st century. Why? Because they'd lost their first love that brought about their origination. They no longer had the love for Christ that their ancestors had. They no longer had the desire to glorify God and enjoy Him forever, as their immigrant ancestors had proclaimed. In the Garden of Eden, God told Adam to tend the garden and exercise dominion over all the earth. Scotch-Irish took the command seriously. Though they wandered for many years and suffered great hardships before they finally settled in America to try to fulfill that mandate in a free country. They are the descendants of the Covenanters and others of Reformation Scotland. And many of us here today are probably descended from them. One of the signers, a number of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were Scottish. And the Scottish and the Scotch-Irish are two different groups, by the way. I mean, I probably ought to add this. I don't know what time it is. 10 till. Okay. I have 10 left or it's 10 till? Okay. All right. Let me just say this. In conclusion, the difference between the Scots and the Scotch-Irish immigration to America. And then what I'd like to do is we'll be done here. But if you want to stay a few minutes and ask questions, we can have a question and answer time after I'm done. It is interesting that many Scots came to America also. not just the Scots-Irish. Those who emigrated directly from Scotland tended to settle in the eastern parts of the country, especially North Carolina. North Carolina was filled with Highlanders, for instance. In 1745, there was a rebellion in Scotland where a number of the clans in the north of Scotland, both Protestant and Catholic, but more Anglican and Catholic than Presbyterian, rebelled against King George II. And they tried to bring back the Stuart heir to the throne. And he has gone down in history as Bonnie Prince Charlie. And somebody with that name is pretty much like what you think somebody with that name is like. But Bonnie Prince Charlie came back to Scotland, and some of the clans rallied to his cause, and they invaded England. Bonnie Prince Charlie was interested in reclaiming the throne of England. But all of his followers of the clans, they were interested in stealing cattle. So when they came into England, that's what they did. They cleaned house, and then they went back to Scotland. Left him standing there. Wait a minute. I'm supposed to become the king of England. Well, the clans didn't care so much about that. Look at all the cattle we got. And they went back to Scotland. And, of course, George II sent his armies to Scotland to punish the clans once and for all. In the Highlands of Scotland, the Reformation had not penetrated in some areas. There were pockets across the Highlands that remained Roman Catholic. Not all of them. There were clans that were totally Presbyterian. There were clans that were totally Roman Catholic. And there were some that remained with their Episcopal loyalties, their Anglican loyalties. So, like everything else in Scotland, it was a mixed bag. But in 1745, and it's called the 45, in the 45, a number of the Catholic and Anglican clans rose up, supported Bonnie Prince Charlie, and the final battle was fought at Culloden in northern Scotland. And there the British destroyed the power of the clans, of the particular clans that were rebellious, and decided to terminate any further rebellion by the mountain clans of Scotland. And so they had what was called the clearances. And the great landlords, the lairds, got rid of thousands of their tenants. And they were transported to America, to Australia, to New Zealand, to Canada. And the Highlands were emptied of people. And it took 30 or 40 years to do it. And there were a variety of reasons why they did it, most of them economic. They found that raising sheep was more profitable than keeping tenants on the land to farm it. They wanted to stalk stags. They didn't want to farm. And so they got rid of them. And there were other complex of reasons. But those Scots who came to America tended to settle in settled areas along the coasts. And they provided the backbone of the loyalist regiments in the War for Independence. Many of the Scots who were here, especially Highlanders, were loyal to the king of all things. The opposite of what you would expect. The exact opposite. When they came to America, they became the king's best friends. And in the War for American Independence, the best regiments that the British sent to fight in America were the Scottish regiments. In fact, the Cameronians, in the War of 1812, the godly Cameronians were almost wiped out in the Battle of New Orleans. Andrew Jackson destroyed the Cameronian regiment in 1812. So Highland regiments were a presence in the British Army in America several times. But the Scottish immigrants tended to support the crown in the War for Independence. So you had Scots on both sides, like always, even in that particular war. Well, with that, I'm going to conclude my talk on the Scots-Irish. There's more that can be said, of course, but I would like to give you the opportunity to ask any questions about anything that we've talked about over these six lectures. Is there anything that we haven't discussed privately that you'd like to ask regarding any of these topics? Yes, ma'am. Of course, I didn't hear a single word she said. I'm hard of hearing. Yes, Francis McKemmie was the first missionary to come and form a Scotch-Irish congregation, Presbyterian congregation, and he formed them all up and down the eastern shore of Maryland. And there are little Presbyterian churches in the eastern shore of Virginia. In fact, there's a McKemmie Memorial Presbyterian Church in Onancock, Virginia, on the eastern shore. And Francis McKemmie established all of these churches, and then a presbytery was organized. And a call went out to Ireland to send more pastors. And a few young men were willing to do it. But there were never, ever enough for the number that migrated and kept moving westward. It was difficult. Even when the Presbyterian churches in America were... Many Presbyterian churches came out of Puritanism in New England and Pennsylvania. Others came out of the Scottish emigration and others out of the Scotch-Irish. But to be educated for the ministry, they had to go back to England and Scotland and Ireland to be educated because there were no institutions here. And Harvard and Yale became liberal so fast that the Presbyterians couldn't use them. Now, eventually, they founded Princeton University and Princeton Seminary and a little Presbyterian seminary in Hampton, Sydney, Virginia, in the South. And then several other small seminaries were founded to train pastors for gospel ministry. But by that time, the Scotch-Irish had flooded into the western areas, and they just couldn't keep up with them. We still have somewhat of that problem today. We have more Presbyterian congregations than we got good men to fill the pulpits. Yes, sir?
How did you get the cast of
Oliver Cromwell? I went to my pastor and said, can I borrow that cast of Oliver Cromwell to take to the conference? And he said, yes. Pastor Moorcraft has a lot of friends in this world, and friends who keep an eye open for strange and unusual things that they think he would like. And one of those friends up in Virginia saw that for sale somewhere. I don't know if it was an auction or how he acquired it. I don't know the backstory, but he gave it to Pastor Moorcraft as a gift, and it is unique. You'll never see another one. They only made a few of them. From the original death mask of Oliver Cromwell. It's a unique artifact. It belongs to Dr. Moorcraft.
Yeah. I read something not too long ago talking about how the Puritans had been so faithful in the 18th century and then into the 19th century that just the faith had fallen away. How do you account for the fact that
that is a huge question, which historians have wrestled with and written books about many times. In fact, there's a book called From Puritan to Yankee by a historian named Bushman, who actually is a Mormon historian. And he's a good historian, but, you know, it's theology. But what he did is he studied that question. How is it that by the 1700s, these godly Puritans of the Reformation period had turned into Yankees? How did that happen? And by that I mean that vital heart religion was no longer of interest to them. Prosperity was really interested in that. They became more and more prosperous. And also, the population of New England, where the Puritans were kind of centered, became much more diverse over the 1700s. People came from all over the place. Germans, Scots-Irish, Scots, French. As you know, as the big cities developed, Philadelphia, Quakers came to Philadelphia. Quakers took over. Pennsylvania was a Quaker colony. I mean, they were heretics, you know, from most Puritan lights. So the population of the country just became so much more diverse. And part of the answer to the question is that the men who of Puritan heritage sort of abandoned the intensity of heart religion that was brought here in the first two generations. And, you know, I don't know if there's a book on this or not, but my theory is that they did not pass on their faith to their children and grandchildren very adequately. And they were easily sucked into the prosperity world of America of the 18th century. They became wealthy and satisfied with their lives, and their personal piety declined. That's my theory, is that they failed to pass on their heritage to the next generation. There's probably a more complex answer. Even psychologists have tried to answer that question, because it is obvious that the first generation of Puritans and the generation that prior to, say, Jonathan Edwards were very different in their spiritual interests in general. Now, you have Jonathan Edwards and you have men like, you have faithful gospel preachers all across New England whose fathers and grandfathers were Puritans. And there were still faithful men preaching the gospel, but the people in the pew, it was spiritually dead time until the Great Awakening came, and things were somewhat changed with the Great Awakening. But again, that's another topic too. I didn't answer your question, I know, but that's all I can say. There are books about that, though. Ma'am. Oh boy. Okay. I've been out of college a long, long time. Would I encourage young people that are going to college to take history courses in college? And I've got a couple different answers to that, one of which I won't even say. But one is, it depends on the college that you go to. If you're going to Liberty University, take every history class you can take. If you're going to Bob Jones University, take every history class you can take. If you're going to the University of Georgia, why? So, you know, it kind of depends on the department. They vary from department to department, and they vary from man to man. There are some good Christian historians outside of the ones I just mentioned, and my alma mater, Cedarville. I don't know if there are any undergraduate colleges that teach from a providential perspective, that is, from a biblical view of history. I don't know if there is anybody. Maybe there is. I just don't know. So in terms of getting a providential or biblical view of history, chances are extremely slim. But you prepare yourself for that. If you're going to take any college course, whether it's history or science, oh my goodness. You know, if you're going to major in biology or sociology, you're never going to run into a Christian, or almost never. And you're only going to get evolutionary theory. So you need to be prepared to glean as much good as you can without losing your faith. You know, the Southern Baptists, the Pew Charitable Trust, or whoever it is that sponsors the Pew, actually it was Barna. It was the Barna group that did that famous, what are they called?
Survey.
A famous survey of Southern Baptist children who went to college and found that 90% abandoned the Christian faith their first year in college. And that's what Al Mohler says. So if you're not already founded in a Christian worldview and confident of what you believe and what you know to be true, it doesn't matter what course you take in college, most likely you're going to get somebody who doesn't believe a single thing that you do and has dedicated their life to making you think the way they do. So whether it's a history department or English department or the sciences, it doesn't matter. But if you're grounded in a Christian worldview, you know what you believe and you can't be moved off of it, and you know how to evaluate everything you're taught biblically, you can survive a college education if that's the way you want to go. You can get a college degree online without ever meeting a single professor. It just depends on what you're going to do. Now, the corollary to that question is, should a person get a degree in history? I get this all the time, you know. My son, my daughter love history. They want to be historians. Can they make a living at doing that? Are you kidding me? No. Not unless they want to teach in a government school. And if they're true Christians, they won't last 5 minutes. Teaching from a biblical presuppositional base. However, if God calls a person to be a historian, they better be a historian. And God will bring them to the place they ought to be. History is a great major if you're going to be going to law. Right, attorney? Wherever you are. History is a great major. It's a great major for going into the ministry. Gospel ministry. It's a great major for a number of other things that it's foundational for. And I would argue that knowing your history is foundational for every academic discipline. I could argue that all day here. Anyway, I answered a question that wasn't asked, so I ask them myself and then I answer them. That's helpful. Yeah. Oh, I have no idea. I don't think they've ever apologized for anything but probably slavery. I really don't know. I'll have to ask J.I. Packer someday. Yes. Somebody's going to have to help me. I didn't hear him. How did they get into Georgia? They came down the valleys and the mountain ranges of the Western Carolinas and down into Georgia, down into the mountains of Georgia. The Scots, a Scottish settlement was made in Georgia very, very early in Georgia history. A bunch of Scots emigrated from Scotland, a whole clan of people, and they were Presbyterian. And they built a little town in southeast Georgia called Darien. And there they built a little Scottish civilization in Georgia. And they were the first Scots to come. And eventually, a real famous church was built there, a Presbyterian church. And members of that particular group, eventually, one of them went up to near where I live, and founded the city of Roswell, or the town of Roswell. And the guy built a mill there and saw all the potential. And he wrote back to his church and his friends back on the coast of Georgia and said, I found the most beautiful, perfect place for business, for building shops and having farms and gardens and mills along the Chattahoochee River. And so almost a whole congregation of people moved up to Roswell, and the Roswell Presbyterian Church are all buried right there in the churchyard. But that's how Roswell was founded, by Scots who emigrated, a whole congregation of them that came to Georgia, and then some of them then moved westward into up past Atlanta. But the Scotch-Irish came down from the Carolinas and just like they did in all other places. And there were Scotch-Irish here in Georgia during the War for Independence and fought on the Patriot side. Okay. Anything else? If you have any other questions as we go along through the afternoon, feel free to ask. And otherwise, Pastor...